Sunday, March 17th, Lyndon was up early and went to St. Francis Xavier, taking Lynn, who sat quietly all during the service, I was told, and was much admired by Father Schneider and the congregation. Lyndon sleeps so little these days. It's one of the things I worry most about him. And then the four of us drove in to St. Barnabas, Linda and Chuck, and Lyndon and I, for the 11 o'clock service. We've lost Reverend McAllister. On the way in, Lyndon said something I will remember for its wisdom. We were talking about the rising tide of isolation in this country, and I was saying how strong it was in me. Not thought, just pure emotion, fed by the actions of such countries as Sweden, hosting a trial of the United States as war criminals, and France's manipulation of the gold. I made a hot-headed statement about when we got the Vietnam War settled finally, I didn't want to have another thing to do with any foreign country. And he looked at me very calmly and said, "That's like saying, James's children have got the smallpox, and I'm not going to do anything about it. James's children live about a block from us. If they had the smallpox, my first thought would be, I've got to be sure they have the best doctor and care. And my next thought would be for our own safety." Or maybe those thoughts would be reversed. At St. Barnabas, the press was lined up in force, Francis and Helen in the forefront, and we walked in slowly, the four of us together. This would be a sort of goodbye picture. The new minister is a youthful, pleasant man, and it was comforting to sink into the ritual of the Episcopal Church. Back at home, we watched the last part of Issues and Answers. Hubert Humphrey was absolutely magnificent. He and Rusk are about the only two who are going out speaking for the administration now. I have a growing feeling of Prometheus bound, just as though we were lying there on the rock exposed to the vultures and really not fighting back. I changed into pants and then, with Lyndon and Matilda and Arthur and Jesse, toured the dance ranch. The McAllisters drove up just as we were leaving. Linda had invited them out, so we left her and Chuck to keep them company. The weather was glorious, with that anticipation of spring in the air. When that fails to excite me, I'll be 90 years old and as good as dead. It was 3 o'clock when we got back to the main house and sat down to lunch. Linda once more sitting by her daddy and the Reverend McAllister by me. The day is too precious to lose, so after lunch, Matilda and Arthur and Jesse and Lyndon and I helicoptered over to A.W.'s, picked him up, and then went to the Davis Ranch. I had wanted to. We haven't been there in months. As you fly over, you see that all the tanks are full, and creeks are flowing that haven't had water in them in years. It's been the wettest spring I remember. Now, if we can just get some sunshine, it ought to be a glorious wildflower season. We bumped around in Broncos over the hills and across the streams, and then we helicoptered to the Krems residence. It was growing chilly. Matilda lit a fire, and the place looked so welcoming. I walked about half the perimeter of their fence line. Matilda has stoutly refused to let the place be bulldozed. Cheers to her. And you make your way through mesquite and cedar and live oaks and granite boulders, the thorny red Christmas cactus, and the azurita yellow with millions of little blossoms. Linda and Chuck came to meet us, and we all helicoptered home. There were Lucy and Pat at long last, with deliriously happy stories of that trip to Laredo. Lucy is convinced that she has more of the best friends in the world, the nicest house in the world, the best husband, and the best baby. This is a typical greeting to her on the phone when she calls her daddy. "Hello, Daddy. I just wanted to make sure you hear a cheerful voice today. I haven't got any problems." The fact that Pat has gotten his orders and is returning to his old unit in Washington and will probably be going overseas in a few weeks or months is no problem to them. That is, that they can't take. Lucy explains the difference between her and Linda. "Mother, I've had a year and a half of married life, and it's been so wonderful, and I'm settled." It was a happy evening altogether. Linda and Chuck and Lucy and Pat, the Krems and Morrisons and Jesse. No meeting would be complete without him. Staff, Jim Jones, Marie, Mary Rather, Larry Temple. Dinner was all Linda Bird's favorites. Steak and spinach and homemade peach ice cream and a great big cake with one single candle on it. We all sang Happy Birthday while she blew it out. Lyndon had already given them his album the day before, and I gave her a small pillow pieced together from fabrics used all over the White House, from the Daniel Webster sofa to the chairs in the family sitting room in the West Hall. It will be a nice piece to remember and identify. And Mr. Fleming delighted her with one of his rare books. By now she has a collection worth a good many $1,000, I expect. The Crams left to catch a plane a little past 10, and Linda and Chuck and I and Mary Ellen played bridge. They are both formidable players, while Lyndon and Jesse and A.W. talked until midnight. And it was only later that I looked back and thought, how wasteful, how foolish of me not to get a family picture. Here were all the six of us at the dinner table, and we had the facilities of the White House photographers. I have the feeling of wasted opportunities, of standing still when I should be running. I see the headline that says, LBJ seeks austerity victory. Kennedy vows new policies. But I stand immobile and watch.